Good morning, Counselor. Are you both ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Mr. Kanaga, I understand you're reserving 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
So the yellow light will come on with five minutes to go. And Mr. Kagami, 5 minute warning, so the yellow light will come on when you're 5 minutes to go. So please proceed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Please, the court, counsel, Johnny Kanaga, Deputy Public Defender, on behalf of Petitioner Appellant Peter L. Bailey. In this case, we respectfully submit that the ICA gravely erred in several instances in the summary disposition order. Perhaps the most compelling of those errors involves the ICA's error in holding that the circuit court did not abuse its discretion in denying the defense's motion for a new trial. The basis for the motion for the new trial was the deliberate interjection of overwhelmingly prejudicial information by a rogue juror during deliberations that Mr. Bailey was a convicted murderer and was on parole when the alleged offenses in this case occurred. Now, there's no dispute from the parties, the circuit court, or the ICA that this information was manifestly prejudicial. In fact, the exclusion of this information was the subject of the defense's motion in limine, and the state had agreed to instruct its witnesses that that information was not to be mentioned during the trial. Now, in spite of the agreement of the parties and the court, precautions taken to ensure that Bailey had received a fair trial, such as individual voir dire of the prospective jurors, a rogue juror deliberately introduced that information during deliberations. And after that information was introduced, the proverbial evidential harpoon abrogated any possibility that Bailey could receive the fair trial that he was entitled to pursuant to Article 1, Section 14 of the Hawaii Constitution.
If I may interrupt you, Counsel.
Yes.
The rogue juror, that was juror number 9, did she indicate anything in her original voir dire that she knew any of the witnesses or the parties or the defendant?
Your Honor, unfortunately, the original voir dire, the individual voir dire of the parties was not part of the record. It was questioned during individual voir dire after the information came to light. She indicated that she had originally mentioned that she knew something in the original individual voir dire. However, she said as she went through the trial and as things went along, more came to light, which is, so the implication was that she had indicated that she had some idea of something happening, but that it wasn't sufficient to warrant a refusal for excusing her for cause.
Well, so, my understanding, not to interrupt you, but is that she said she knew that the defendant had been in some kind of trouble, but she didn't know what that was, whether it was a charge or conviction.
I believe she had stated, the only reference to it was she said that she had said that in the original questioning, I guess she had mentioned that she knew something had happened, and she referenced in a church, so it was unclear whether she had been confused with the current case or the previous case involving the murder conviction.
So we don't know whether that disclosure was ever followed up by either counsel.
It appears that it was not followed up because there was no indication of a challenge for cause or a motion to or a peremptory challenge that jurors stayed on. So yes, there was no indication that that was brought to light and challenged.
Thank you.
Are you saying the original voir dire is not recorded? There's no record of the original voir dire.
The original voir dire was recorded, however, it was not ordered by our office as part of the record.
So it exists, but it's not in our record.
Correct. It exists, so the court does not have a copy before it. In any case, so the after this juror had introduced this evidence, the test for determining whether Mr. Bailey was deprived of his right to a fair trial, the standard was set forth, I guess, by this court in State v. Kim, which is 103 Hawaii 285. So initially, we bear the burden of making a prima facie showing of a deprivation that could substantially prejudice Bailey's right to a fair trial by an impartial jury. And we establish that by showing, one, that the comment was improper, and two, that the comment was used as a circumstance against the defendant. Okay, so first, it's obvious that this comment was improper. The parties had agreed, as I stated earlier, that the information of Bailey's prior murder conviction and parole status was not to be introduced at trial. And Hawaii case law, such as Kalihulukai, one of the cases cited in the briefs, also establishes the overwhelming prejudicial effect of such prior conviction information. And then second, the information was directly about Bailey, so it was obviously used as a circumstance against him.
But those cases and that evidentiary will apply when it's discovered after the verdict. This is a situation where all the jurors were in question, and they all said that they wouldn't use it.
Yes, Your Honor.
So I think you're using an improper standard.
There was a motion for a new trial made after the trial. The jurors were not questioned. The jurors' questioning was actually right after the misconduct took place. Now, I realize that HRE Rule 606 applies to post-verdict and post-indictment, I guess, proceedings where the jurors are questioned. However, if you look at the rationale behind that rule, one of the overriding rationales is to avoid this, and I believe Justice Nakayama stated that in Kim, was that you want to avoid delving into the jury's deliberation process and their thought process, which is one of the reasons why the rule prohibits the court from inquiring into the effect of the misconduct upon the jurors. So the principle would be the same, I would contend, in mid-trial or after trial. But in any case, if we just look at the basic standard for the denial of the mistrial or denial for motion for new trial, it's an abuse of discretion. Now,
so your argument is that the judge shouldn't ask the jurors whether it's going to affect them?
The judge is allowed to ask the jurors the nature of the misconduct. However, at that point, if we look at the cases on post-verdict challenges as instructive, then the court should make an objective determination based on just looking at the nature of the misconduct, without regard to what the jurors say the effect on them is going to be. Although the jury is presumed always to obey the instruction of the court and be forthright, it's obvious that in some cases that this is kind of a legal fallacy which we use to determine cases. For instance, in this case, the jury was instructed after the trial proceedings that there was a possibility of an extended term hearing coming up. So they were told not to read any media accounts, not to discuss the case with anybody. But when they were recalled for the extended term hearing, four jurors admitted that they had read newspapers or listened to media accounts or spoken to people about it, which is why there weren't sufficient number of jurors to proceed with the extended term hearing. So while we have this presumption that the jury is going to follow the instructions and that the jury is going to listen to what the court says and that the jury is going to be forthright and voir dire, there's also a presumption that in this case, especially, that the jury didn't do so. For example, the jury was also instructed not to look at outside information. The jury was instructed prior to the proceedings that it was to only consider the evidence presented at trial. Now, obviously, it didn't listen to that admonition because she brought in this evidence. And she did it knowing full well that she was not supposed to, because she prefaced her introduction of this evidence by saying, I have information and, I'm basically not supposed to do this, but I think you guys need to know this. And then she proceeded to tell the other jurors about
it. I'm sorry, did she say, I know I'm not supposed to do this? Which juror ascribed that to her?
There were several.
One juror indicated that she said she had some outside information, inside information, but was there some statement by her that I know I'm not supposed to do this?
I think I may be paraphrasing a little bit, but however, okay, so he's affected by knowledge of the charge against Bailey. Maybe he knows what he's doing because he's been through that process before, he's been in trouble before, from what I know, it's a murder charge. And let me see. I've got some inside information that you guys don't have and that you should know about. So the implication is that she knew she wasn't supposed to give this information out, and that she did.
Well, that's your implication. That's not
correct. Okay. It's not a direct quote.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Does that really matter? I mean, isn't the issue? I mean, suppose they had read it. It had been the headlines of the newspaper. It said, "Jury continues deliberation in convicted murder." In other words, it's what her motive was. Is that important?
No, not in that regard, but it just shows that I was responding to the question regarding whether the jurors are going to comply with the court's instructions. The jurors are presumed to follow these instructions, and obviously, this is a presumption that's made to support rulings and opinions. However, in reality, we all know that doesn't happen a lot of the time, and fortunately, in this case, the jurors were somewhat forthright about what had been said or what had been said. However, even if you look at the questioning, as you were asking about Chief Justice, the interpretation or what was said differed greatly from juror to juror. She kind of downplays what she says. One juror is very clear what was said, and he said, yes, she said it was murder, and he was on parole. In fact, another juror, when questioned, stated that he actually heard another juror say that it said he was convicted for murder. So I think Justice Acoba brought this up in his dissenting opinion in Kim. You know, there's this question of whether the jurors are, you know, being forthright with their responses. And I think that while the motivation of the juror may not matter directly, it goes to show the nature of the misconduct and the severity of the misconduct. Because actually the jury had taken a vote. There was an indication that the jury had taken a vote before deciding to even inform the court that this misconduct had occurred. So there was even a possibility that the judge wouldn't have been notified of this. So I don't know if I'm answering your question properly, but I think the bottom line is that the nature of this misconduct was just overwhelmingly prejudicial. I think there's maybe two offenses or two circumstances that could have been brought up that would have been this prejudicial, and one would have been that Bailey had allegedly committed another sex assault similar to this one. Second would be murder, because of the nature of that crime being the most serious crime.
Oh, I think not. Cases across the country, there are situations where juries have actually been threatened, and it's been while the juries have been deliberating. There's all kinds of situations that are equivalent to this situation. In other words, it seems like your argument is that because it was murder, all of a sudden the fact that it was murder, and that's what was stated, we have to have this automatic sort of determination to kind of disregard a judge who inquired of these jurors, sat down and looked at them, evaluated what they said, and took their answers and said, these jurors can put it out of their mind. All these jurors, as you said, were pretty forthright, and they even admitted, it bothered me, but I can put it aside.
Well, initially some of the jurors actually had admitted, and it also came out that during the deliberations when this information first came out, some of them said, hey, you know what, that's it, it's over. We're gone, we're compromised. And even the communication itself kind of says, we believe we may be compromised as a body. Now, I understand that the fact that it's murder is not as compelling to you. However, I would contend that, you know, if it comes out in a situation where, for instance, it's relevant to the charge, for instance, in a felon in possession, and the state is required to prove the underlying felony. Now, in those type of cases, the court, the parties can take a number of steps to ensure that the information, the prejudicial effect of the information is mitigated. So we can have limiting instructions given as soon as the information comes out. In the case of felon in possession, they don't have to specify the underlying felony. They can stipulate to it rather than have proof. The problem in this case was that this was a totally uncontrolled situation. You know, the juror blurted it out during deliberations. She wasn't forthright about exactly what was said. And I think if you look at it, the jurors appear to try to.
Counsel, may I ask, did the jurors talk about that information among themselves before they shut down their deliberations? Was there discussion about that information?
Well,
or not?
If you look at the responses, the most discussion I guess there was that one of the jurors had said, hey, you know what, we got to stop. One of them had actually used more, and then that was when they decided to tell the court. There was no indication that they started talking about it directly, that information up in the context of when they were watching the DVD of an interview between Detective Artienda and Mr. Bailey, and what she had said was during the interview, Mr. Bailey is kind of denying that he remembers a lot of stuff, and she said, I don't find that believable because he's been through this before. And that's, the circumstance. So there, to the extent after the information came out, I don't believe there was an extensive discussion.
Well, did the other jurors ask her about the circumstances of the offense, whether he was on parole,
there was one indication. I think one of the jurors had stated that somebody asked, what is it for or something, and then she had said murder as a circumstance. How repeat it, and then she continued and repeated herself, and she said, oh, he's on parole. So there was a varying degree of, I guess, there's a little disparity in specifically what was said, but it was kind of presumed that most of the jurors had heard the fact that he was convicted for murder and the fact that he was on parole at the time. So,
Mr. Kanaga, yes. I'm curious about Judge Pollack's question. Would you agree that threatening a juror is probably worse than a juror mentioned, insofar as extrinsic information or conduct that the jury shouldn't be privy to? Would you say that's worse than information about murder?
I'm not sure if I can quantify it in terms of degrees. I would say that both would directly interfere with the processes, or the extrinsic information of the murder, however, interjects something that is outside of the supposed jury's consideration of the case.
Well, so would threatening a jury. Suppose somebody said, I'm the defendant, and you better find me not guilty.
Oh, well, yes, correct. So in that type of cases, I believe it was Kim, when they were speaking about the juror who had actually revealed that information had come out about the firearm use, and second, that she had felt threatened by information or by statements made by the other juror that, I guess, they had taken an initial vote, and she said, she had voted manslaughter, and then one of the jurors demanded to know who the F, voted manslaughter, I want to know. And I believe the majority of the court quantified that as not a threatening type of behavior. So if you're speaking of something greater than that, such as your example where, somebody approaches the juror outside, I would say that is sufficiently serious to also.
Well, then if we disregarded, along with Judge Pollack's question, if we disregarded the judge's examination of the jurors and based it solely on the severity of the indiscretion, couldn't a defendant always get a new trial by arranging to have somebody threaten a juror?
Well, I mean, I would guess that you could, however, I would think that, because of the, I guess, relative rarity of such a situation, what I'm really asking the court to look at is on a case-by-case basis. In this situation, the information came out that he was, he was a convicted murderer and on parole. Now, the problem, especially in this type of case, too, is this is a sexual assault involving a minor in the church. So the allegations themselves are already highly emotionally charged. It's a very tenuous type of case where the jury is more apt to give into its emotions, prejudices, because of the nature of the allegations.
But your jurors were very, okay, that's it. They didn't try and hide it. They didn't try and say, I'm going to try and get this guy. They were pretty upfront and upfront.
Correct. I believe that in some instances they were forthright about the information coming out, that the relative nature of the information, but it appears that, as I said, they did minimize. There was indication that, jurors disregarded later statements or admonitions by the court. So to presume that the responses that they gave were wholly correct is also is not 100% reliable as well, because presumably in the beginning of the case, the court instructs the jury, and we have that part of it, at least, the preliminary instruction where the court instructs the jury not to talk about with anybody about the case. Your verdict is going to be based on the evidence adduced at trial. And the jury obviously disregarded that part of the instructions by then attempting.
Isn't the trial judge in the best position to assess these kinds of issues on a case-by-case basis, seeing those jurors, talking with them, hearing what they have to say, observing their demeanor, and determining whether they can indeed be fair and impartial despite what they heard?
Well, if we go to 606 and use that as instructive, not binding on the court, then we shouldn't really look at the responses of the jurors as to how it specifically affected them. We can look at the jurors' testimony as to what the misconduct was and, the circumstances of what happened. Then the court is only to make an objective determination. Now, for the court to say that, for instance, if a prosecution witness had in the beginning said, interjected this information, said, hey, this guy's on parole for, murder, and, in violation of the motions in limine, that would likely lead to a declaration of a mistrial. Now,
aren't we in a little better situation? In that case, the judge doesn't individually voir dire the juror. Here, you actually have the jurors individually voir dire. Counsel, I was going to ask you about, and perhaps because of your time, you might think, are you going to be talking about the substitution process? Are you
the 24C?
Correct.
I was going to lead into that if you wanted me to. Okay, so the error then got compounded because the court, and we have to presume that the court knew that this was incorrect, had retained the alternates, and then ceded the alternate after. Just look at the Weidman case, which is one case that deals with this violation of Rule 24. This court applied a harmless error analysis to that case in that situation. However, the underlying problem with this substitution of the alternates is the fact that when the alternate comes in, there's the potential of undue pressure exerted upon them to conform to the vote that the jury has already taken. Now, we know that this jury has taken a preliminary result. We also know that after the alternate was seated, the jury sent a communication saying, look, we're having a problem. One of the jurors is, what if a juror doesn't want to vote on one count? What if we can't agree, you know, we can't convict him on, agree on this other count? So there was indications that difficulties arose after the seating of the alternate. Now, again, we don't have direct evidence, such as the testimony of the jurors, as to exactly what happened, and subsequently, they were able to reach a unanimous verdict.
Did the judge ever ask counsel, defense counsel, for example, whether counsel wanted to stipulate to 11 jurors or something like that? There's other alternatives in the rule that the court could have proceeded upon.
There was no indication that the court considered any alternative other than to seat the alternate juror.
One other question. Do you think this harmless beyond a reasonable doubt is the correct standard? Because that's not the standard that's used in federal courts and state courts in many places across the country.
Well, personally, I don't. In this situation where the court is aware of the rule and knowingly violates the rule and then uses the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard as a fallback to say, hey, look, I know I violated the rule, but it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and because, you know, there was this overwhelming evidence, I think that's not the proper method for the courts to employ. Now, if the courts want to go ahead and, you know, amend the rule, you know, they can try and amend the rule. For instance, I think in California, there's specified procedures for seating the alternates. So the alternates are retained, I believe, throughout the deliberation process. So they have these safeguards. Now, the court follows some of the safeguards, which are outlined in other jurisdiction case laws, such as instructing the jury to begin its deliberations anew, elect a new foreperson, that kind of thing. However, again, when you look at Weidman, it actually says that that's just to mitigate the possibility of this undue influence. It doesn't say that just because you do it, it totally eliminates the undue influence. So, which means that I would then agree with your suggestion, because it lends itself then to the court having to justify itself through this harmless error analysis.
How long after the alternate was seated did the jury return a verdict?
The alternate was seated. The new jury began deliberations at 11 o'clock, approximately 11 o'clock on June 2nd. So they deliberated for about 4 hours that day, if you take out the hour for lunch. Then they went through June 3rd, June 4th, and returned on June 5th. So it was a total of about 18 to 20 hours of deliberations.
And prior to that, they had taken about 2 days?
They had started deliberations on May 28th at 3 o'clock, and so they went about 1.5 hours. Then May 29th was, they had started deliberations, and about 2 hours into it, problem. So they had gone about 3.5 hours on that day. Then the court had excused, after doing the individual voir dire, excused the jurors. They came back on June 2nd. So, yeah, about like, the original deliberations were pretty short, about 5 to 6 hours.
But they had already taken votes?
The jury indicated that they had, when they went in, they had taken an initial preliminary vote to see where everybody stood, and then they began their, I guess, review of the evidence. So there was no indication at that time that there was this problem.
So there's no clear indication that they had not followed the jury, the judge's instructions to begin deliberations anew.
No.
I mean, just looking at it.
Yeah, there's nothing in the record directly implicating the fact that they didn't. However, as I said earlier, you know, if you look at that, when this reconstituted jury came back, they returned their verdict. Then they're instructed, you know, okay, you guys may come back for the extended term hearing.
So is harmless error the correct standard?
For the violation of the 24C?
Yeah.
Well, That's the statement which was implicated in life. So the case law at this point would say that. However, as I was speaking to Justice Pollack, I believe that in a case where the rule is mandatory, it says shall dismiss the alternate, there shouldn't be a need for the harmless error analysis at that point. It should just be a violation of the rule leads to the relief we seek.
Well, some state courts have a presumption of prejudice and require extraordinary steps to counteract, especially when you put in a juror into a deliberating jury who's already reached decisions. And the judge in this case, I don't believe, told the jury that they had to, told them to start deliberations anew, but it didn't seem like he told them, look, at any decision you have to, you've reached, you're going to have to put it aside.
Thank
you. Counsel, would you like to reserve your time then at this point?
Yes.
Okay. Come.
May it please the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Michael Kagami for the State of Hawaii. I really have no prepared remarks for the court. I did want to reserve all my time to answer any concerns, issues, or questions from the court. I would like to begin, however, by answering some questions that were raised. With respect to the seating of the alternate juror, I believe Justice Pollack asked, were there any alternatives or so did the court inquire? And I believe the court did, but I believe in chambers asked defense counsel if they were willing to go with 11 jurors.
Is that on the record?
That is not on the record.
How about 10? How about 9 or 8? In other words, there are three jurors who potentially could have been tainted. Maybe defense counsel would have been very pleased to get rid of jurors that the defense counsel thought may have been adverse.
I believe the inquiry in chambers was just to go with 11. That was prior to individual voir dire, however.
I'm not sure you should be raising
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, that's not on the record, right, counsel?
I was just trying to ask you the question.
Okay.
With respect to how long prior to the misconduct occurred, I believe the jurors were deliberating about 5 hours. And subsequent to the replacement, over 3 days. The new jury started June 2nd. They came back the afternoon of June 5th, so over the course of about 3 days.
The defense raises at the tail end of its argument the idea that the case should be dismissed or there should be a new trial because of the fact that the courtroom was closed approximately from 2 o'clock on. And then the court said, well, it would do the voir dire over again following day. One, did that occur? And two, does that mean that the court reiterated its questions and counsel had to reiterate their questions?
With respect to whether or not the door was locked, I don't think that's really clear on the record. From the testimony of the guard that was in the courtroom, all she said was that she heard jiggling and that the door didn't subsequently open. Now, we don't know whether or not because that person changed his mind and decided not to come in or whether or not the door was locked. There's no clear indication that the door was in fact locked. With respect to the re-questioning of the jurors, the next day, I believe the court had a standard protocol and types of questions it would ask. So I believe, while may not be verbatim in content, virtually the same.
And the attorneys re-questioned the jurors?
The attorneys had the opportunity to re-question the jurors, yes.
Right. Well, did they or didn't they? Well, let me ask you, was that voir dire recorded, that second day?
Yes. All voir dire was recorded.
Okay.
And is that in the record, though?
That is not in the record.
Mr. Kagami.
Yes.
I understand that this was a serious case involving serious charges with a child witness. Isn't there some point that over past which juror misconduct, I mean, it's a murder. It's an accusation that he committed a murder. How is that not overwhelmingly prejudicial?
I understand that it's prejudicial. However, to preclude, basically what you're doing is precluding the juror from sitting anytime they know of this prior murder. And I don't think that's what we do. We look at, can this person still one, disregard that prior knowledge, and two, still be fair and impartial in spite of knowing that.
Suppose the information came out before trial, and the juror wasn't seated yet, and during the initial voir dire, the case said, well, I know that the guy's committed a murder, has been in jail for murder. Mm-hmm. You're saying that's not for cause? That juror couldn't be excused for cause?
I think you have to go to the next step then. Knowing that, are you then not fair and impartial? Can you not set that aside? I think you have to take that next step. Just knowing that alone does not preclude you from being a fair and impartial juror. And that's what I believe.
But the questioning of the jurors, weren't the jurors just all over the map about what supposedly was said in this room where they all were within hearing distance of the juror who spoke? Some thought it was he was on parole, some didn't, some thought it was a conviction, some thought it was an accusation. People seemed very uncertain, and about their recollection seemed perhaps hesitant. Some, three of them were explicitly hesitant about their ability to be fair and impartial. Doesn't that tend to support the conclusion that, in fact, this information had irrevocably tainted the jury?
I don't think so, because if you look in the context of what happens in a jury room, I think perhaps there's multiple discussions going on at the same time. I'm not sure in what context made her statement. Was she the one that had basically the whole attention of everyone in the room? I think it's not uncommon that people have different recollections of what is said and what is heard, even though they're in the same room. That's like in any case, let's say this crime. I mean, you can have multiple witnesses viewing one incident, and they'll have different recollections of what they saw or what said. So I don't think based on that you can say that.
You know, with regard to a public trial, again, getting back to that, does it make any difference if the closing of the court was inadvertent or it was subject to some court order? Does it make any difference?
I believe so, because I think most of the cases in which it's held to be improper, there's some affirmative act by the court.
Why would that make a difference if the purpose of having a public trial is, for example, to make sure that everybody does their job correctly according to the Supreme Court, and that that would encourage witnesses to come forward and prevent perjury? Wouldn't the same reasons apply whether the closing was inadvertent or intentional?
I think based upon the case law, it does matter. I think you look at what the values are.
I'm asking you, what do you think? Does it make sense? I know you told me what the case law is,
right.
But does it make sense? I mean, whether it's inadvertent or intentional, the same thing happens, right? Because the courtroom's closed.
I believe, I agree with you in some context that it's the same thing.
As far as the argument by the defense about substantial evidence not being present to support the attempted sexual assault charge, and there not being a rational basis for conviction on that charge, they're really two sides of the same issue.
Right? I agree.
And how do you answer that? You don't need to go through everybody's testimony, but what's your answer to that?
Well, I think when you look at the testimony of the victim, her brother, and her uncle, they're all consistent with one another. The victim and Mr. Bailey are both undressed. They're both in a darkened room, or at one point darkened room. It's an isolated, it's not a church that's open at that time. You have Mr. Bailey's statement to the police in which he's so sorry. And
the defense's argument is that the evidence is that there was penetration. So
correct.
What's your response to that?
Your Honor, Justice, I believe if you look at the other testimony, a reasonable juror could find that there in fact was not penetration. Merle Ando was the forensic scene nurse that testified. She found no physical injuries upon doing a scene exam. So I think a reasonable juror could conclude from that testimony that, yes, although there are substantial steps to accomplish the acts of sexual penetration did not in fact occur.
But that would be true with regard to penetration digitally and with this penis, correct?
Correct.
There was also allegations of oral sex in this case.
Correct.
And how what would your answer be with regard to those counts?
I believe when you look at the surroundings that the victim found herself in, she's a 12-year-old in a darkened room. I believe at one point her eyes and mouth were covered with her bra. So, you know, the senses were dulled at that point. So, you know, whether or not actual sexual penetration could occur, I believe that those facets of evidence could go against her, in fact, not being actually sucking on his penis or having him lick her vagina.
And the jurors could reach that decision because why?
They're the ones that decide what to believe and what not to believe with respect to the evidence.
I'd like to take you back to the substitution. I'd like to ask you if the judge in this case, after the evidence had all been concluded, before they started deliberating, had taken one of the jurors back into the judge's chambers and sat down with that juror without counsel, without the defendant, without being on the record, and had a discussion, and then had the juror go back and deliberate, would you agree that that would be a very serious problem?
If that juror then became a substitute juror?
Yes, if that juror went back and started deliberating.
That'd be a problem.
Isn't that what happened in this case?
No.
I think if you take a look at the transcript, what happened in this case is after the jurors departed to begin deliberation, the judge asked all the alternates to come into his chambers. And this is what he said. He said, if you have time, I would like to meet all of you. He's talking to all the alternates. First of all, you will be excused, and you can basically go about whatever it is that's your normal lifestyle from now on. But if you have some time, I would like to meet all of you in chambers and express my personal thanks, but I also need to leave your contact information with the bailiff before you leave. So then he goes through, takes all the information, and then at the very close of the thing, he says, okay, we're back on the record. Anything further? No, judge. No, judge. Okay, court is adjourned, and the court will see the alternate jurors in chambers. And that alternate juror, what I read, eventually gets substituted in. And there's nothing on the record to clarify what that discussion was. This is off the record, without counsel. We don't know how long they talked. We don't know what they talked about. We don't know what subject matters. State versus Estrada has a statement in there that when a judge goes into a jury room without anybody there, and this is the exact identical situation of pulling a juror into chambers and discussing it with the juror, we don't know, as Estrada said, what kind of special verbal emphasis or facial expressions that the judge may have engaged in. And proof that's what the judge's practice was is when they eventually excused juror number 9, the judge took juror number 9 back in the chambers after they excused juror number 9. So this looks like a regular practice that the judge goes back and talks to these jurors. It's one thing when you discharge jurors, but the substitution here wasn't a discharge.
I'm sorry, I'm without benefit of that portion of the transcripts. My recollection is, and I will rely on the transcripts, but my recollection is the judge didn't take back the alternates once the initial phase was completed, before they started deliberating. I believe as a normal practice, he does do that once verdict is reached.
Okay, you're off the record talking about what's on the record. Yeah. It looks like he took them back. There's nothing indicating that the judge didn't. And what the federal courts do is they look at the potential prejudice to the defendant. Some state courts presume prejudice in this situation. It's up to the government to show that there wasn't prejudice. And with this record, I'm not sure how you accomplish that.
I would have to look at the transcripts. I don't know in what context that was done.
Well, counsel, was there an objection raised at trial by a defense counsel to the seating of the juror on this basis? And if not, is this an issue that would be appropriate for plain error review?
No, it was not objected to by trial counsel, and yes, it's subject to plain error.
You agree the standard is whether or not, going back to the jurors, whether the defendant whether the defendant's right to a fair trial was substantially prejudiced. Is that correct? Is that the standard?
I'm sorry.
Is the standard on whether or not defense was entitled to a new trial because of what occurred in the jury room. Is the standard for us to apply that the defendant was whether or not the defendant was right to a fair trial was substantially prejudiced?
Yes.
So, it's just as Nakayama indicated, if the jurors know that or have word that the defendant committed a murder and was on parole, would it be reasonable to assume that they can put that out of their mind once they hear it?
It's reasonable, yes. It would be based upon the individual juror. And that's why the court or the party should question that when that comes up. And like Chief Justice said, that the trial judge is really in the best position to evaluate those answers that are given.
Are there any further questions? If not, thank you, Mr. Kagami. Mr. Ikenaga, your rebuttal. And if I could, would you start by addressing the issue of sufficiency of the evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. Our issue is the sufficiency of evidence to support the attempted sexual assault in the first-degree charges was based on the fact that the only testimony at trial was that penetration actually occurred, and defense counsel during cross-examination took pains to have the complaining witness specify exactly what she meant. There didn't seem to be any ambiguity. For instance, as to the penile penetration, the defense counsel asked, well, how far into did you feel it? Did you feel it up by your stomach? And she said, no, by her hips. So she specified that she could actually feel it inside her. As for the other acts, which was digital penetration, she stated that while he was asking her to suck his penis, he was then fingering her, putting his fingers inside her. So there was no ambiguity where, for instance, in a type of attempt where she would say like, oh, he put his hand down the front of my panties, and that could be seen as an attempt to digitally penetrate her, but which was never completed. So our argument as to sufficiency is that there wasn't sufficient evidence to support the attempt. But
wasn't the argument of the defense at trial that the physical evidence indicated there was no penetration? So could the jury not have believed that that was indeed the case, that there wasn't penetration, but that there was an action or an attempt by the defendant to penetrate the victim, which wasn't successful?
Well, it appears that the jury didn't totally believe the complainant in that sense, that because if you believe the complainant, these acts of sexual penetration actually took place. So we would contend that, you know, if you want to say that there's a generalized intent from him taking her to this room, taking off, you know, her clothes, it shouldn't be specific to each of the specific acts alleged. That there would have to be some sort of substantial step toward each of those specific acts that the jury believed occurred. And based on the state of the evidence, you know, even if you look at Sedino's testimony, that when he came in, he said, you know, Mr. Bailey was between her legs licking her, that the acts of sexual penetration would have actually occurred based on the witness's testimony. And, you know, we would contend at some point that the verdict of finding him guilty of the attempts was actually evidence more the fact that the jury was tainted by that prejudicial information, so it was seeking to reach a verdict to convict him without taking regard of the evidence and the fact that there was no evidence, direct evidence, physical evidence of sexual penetration.
Thank you, counsel. Continue with your argument. I'm sorry. Okay.
I was just going to say, maybe this doesn't go specifically to what you said, but the nurse did indicate to us she didn't find any injuries, right?
Correct.
So that you could deduce from that that there was no penetration.
Yes, the nurse?
And the court did tell the jury, I think, at least three times, you can believe all or part of a witness's testimony. So you have a difficult mountain to climb here, don't you?
Yes, but however, the point I was trying to make was that to find the attempt for each of the specific acts, you know, there has to be some testimony that, for instance, that support a substantial step toward that particular act. Now, you can't, if you don't believe that the penetration occurred, then you don't believe that the complainant's testimony is that. Basically, you disregard the complainant's testimony.
They walked in and she didn't have any clothes on. I mean, an included attempt is included on every offense. You're going to have an attempt on every completed offense anyhow, because at some point you're going to start the act, and just before it's going to be attempt, even if it's raising your arm and just before you shoot, or, you know, it's taking off your pants or whatever it is, it seems to me there's always going to be a substantial step before the completed offense.
I would agree, but in terms of a generalized, like if they had just charged him with a general sexual assault in the first degree charge, rather than four specific acts alleged, then I would say if you're going to find him guilty of attempt, you have to find a substantial step toward that shows that he was going to commit each of those four specified acts. So as my example earlier, for instance, for digital penetration, that he put his hand down by my vagina and, you know, was doing something on it, for instance, that might be sufficient evidence to show an attempt to digitally penetrate her. But if her testimony is he did digitally penetrate her and there's nothing else, or he did put his penis inside me and felt it inside me and there's nothing else, then I don't think there's that substantial step that leads to the act.
If this goes back for a new trial, your client can only be charged with attempted sexual assault.
Any wrap up? Anything to wrap up, Mr. Kanaga, or is that?
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. Appreciate your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.